The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
It's that time again. Time for the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Today, my marvelous guest, Carlisle G. Leach, has had extensive entrepreneurial leadership positions with business, government, and educational sectors. He has also written a wonderful book entitled 6 Days in December, My Father's Journey Home. Welcome, Carlisle.
Thank you. It's good to be here on the Stephen Davis Show.
I appreciate it. We talk about stuff here. It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk with so many different folks. I have fun talking to folks, and I'm going to have fun talking to you, too. So I always start off my show by talking about your childhood and what you've done and things of that sort. So let's start first with your childhood. Where were you born at, Carlisle?
All right. So I remember being in utero. No. As you are aware, I'm a twin. I'm the younger twin. My brother is Thomas Leach Jr. And then I have my sister who came after us, Robin Leach Harris. But yeah, I was born in Brooklyn at Brooklyn Jewish Hospital right there in Prospect Heights. And back in 1953, at the height of all the craziness in the world with what's his name, Joe McCarthy, and anti-communist stuff going on at that point. So, of course, I don't remember that stuff, but looking back at it as a history teacher, I see that Ethel Rosenberg during that time as well. So anyhow, yeah, born in Brooklyn, lived in Brooklyn until I guess about 56-ish, at which point Daddy and Mommy, Daddy being Thomas R. Leach Sr. and my mom, Jean Audrey Cumberbatch Leach, decided they wanted to move the family from Macon Street in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy, or as some of our new gentrified people like to say, or gentrifying people like to say, Bed-Stuy. It's Bed-Stuy, right? Accent on the-
Or Stuyvesant Heights. Well, they get even better, Stuyvesant Heights.
But that's all right. Stuyvesant, at least that's been around for a while. Sometimes people don't realize it comes from Bedford Stuyvesant. So that's those are the accents. But anyhow, so we went from Bed-Stuy on Macon Street, across the street from Our Lady of Victory Church to Queens. My grandparents continued to live on Macon Street until they passed in 1970. So we would spend a lot of time with my grandparents playing stickball on the street when there were probably maybe like 8 cars on the block, as opposed to now with his parking all up and down the street. But you know, it's funny how you look back at some of those pictures or have those memories and it's, yeah, the streets were pretty empty because not as many people drove. But yeah, so we used to spend many long weekends, long weeks with them while my parents, we didn't even think about it. We'd be hanging out at Granny and Grandpa's house. And we were just saying, wow, this is a great time, not realizing that Mommy and Daddy were having a great time without us kids, because we couldn't even fathom how could parents have a better time or a good time without us kids around. So it wasn't until I was an adult, I was like, I wonder what they were doing when they were with us. It's like they were partying, they were going out, they're just resting and taking it easy. Yeah, so we followed that, my folks followed that Robert Moses like bait to have us go into the what was then the suburbs of Springfield Gardens. And we went out to Springfield Gardens and basically grew up there, lived there for about 4 years. And then we moved to St. Albans, Addisley Park, where I became an adult there, and then moved back to Brooklyn. And then had my family, got married to Annette Vengees Leach, been married now 36 years, have 2 sons, Hayward Lord Leach and August Zermatt Leach. So they're in their 20s now, and I'm pleased with things that they're doing, and they're happy with their lives. So basically, I mean, that's like a snapshot geographically more than anything else.
Tell me some of the famous people that lived in Adelaide Park.
Addis Lay Park. Yeah, that's okay. Count Basie. Count Basie, Brooke Benton, Lena Horne.
Didn't James Brown live out there and, near there?
Exactly right. James Brown. In fact, when we used to play in the street, we'd say, car! And we'd have run to the side, walk to the, we didn't run, we walked to the side. He was like, what are you doing driving down our block? And then it was many times it was James Brown driving in his Eldorado and his license plate was, it's a man's world. We used to just wave as he went by. But yeah, him and so many other people, they don't come to mind.
Louis Armstrong?
Louis Armstrong. I think he was more in Corona.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I think he's more Corona. Yeah, there's so many people who lived. Oh, Jackie Robinson. He actually lived.
Oh, Jackie Robinson. Oh, you the baseball coach and you say, oh, yeah. That he should have been remember. The first one that you remember.
I know. Sorry, Jackie. Number 42. I'm sorry. But yeah, Jackie. In fact, my godfather, John Dudley, lived in Jackie's house later on. And yeah. So Addis Lay Park, yes, that was the place where a lot of folks went. I didn't feel it because I was a kid, but folks went there because they felt comfortable. African-American people who were doing pretty well, who went there, didn't feel like they had to watch their back because they were going to be given the side eye by the then Karens from that day. So it was, yeah, for me growing up there, in the 60s and 70s was magnificent, made some great friends. And of course, that was the height of the baby boomers. So we used to have so many friends who it felt like 90% of the friends were male. So we used to play baseball, basketball, softball at the parks and on the street and people's backyards. And that's all we did. We just played all day, depending upon the time of year. It was baseball. Once it got to the fall, we started playing football in the street. Excuse me. And it was just guys all around. And it was, like I said, it was just a beautiful time and met some really great people who continue to be great friends and brothers to this day.
Tell us a little bit about your mother.
Okay. Mom born in Brooklyn, New York, and mom went to Brooklyn College where she met dad. Mom was going to be in show business. My mother's background, as is my dad's background, is from Barbados. Both sets of their parents immigrated from Barbados and had their kids here. And then mommy and daddy actually met at Brooklyn College. So mom was going to be in showbiz. At one point they were calling her like the Black Shirley Temple because mom could dance and sing, big personality. But my grandmother, who we called Nana was like, nope, you are not. You're going to be a teacher. This was back in the 30s and 20s and 30s. It's like, nope, that's not something that you're going to do. We didn't come here for you to be an entertainer. It's dangerous. They take advantage of you. Of course, you know, all those things were true. So mom then got her master's and everything, became an educator and an assistant principal with the New York City Department of Education. At that point, it's Board of Education, where she made a wonderful career and impacted on many students from 231 PS Junior High School 231 in Queens. And then she finished her career as an assistant principal at Jackie Robinson Junior High School in that's Crown Heights now. So yeah, so then mom raised us, always busy, joined the Lynx organization. Mom was very active in the Addis Lay Park Civic Association. She made sure we knew which fork to use and which knife to use when we ate and make sure that we were always, you know, dressed up.
I was going to say earlier was when you mentioned Macon Street, my mother died maybe about 3 years ago. And before she died, she said to me on the phone one day, oh, you used to live in Brooklyn. Really? I never knew that.
Wow.
She said, oh, yes, your grandfather had a house on Macon Street. And another, I found out that some of the relatives, not my relatives, but some of the folks went to it was a cleaners that was owned by Mortimer Bowman. That was my grand uncle. Didn't know him.
So where did you grow up then, Steve?
My father was a military, so okay. I grew up all over Japan, North Carolina, just different places that my father had gone, but they really settled in North Carolina because he was at Fort Bragg. That's where I went to high school in Fayetteville because my father was military.
Okay. Now, do you remember, I was at 295. Macon Street. I don't know if, did you ever go by the house that live in?
Okay. I don't know. There's another Bowman that live in the next block. I discovered that about 2 years ago.
Wow.
In the next block. So I went past that house and I looked at it.
Okay.
It was just interesting. One of the things in terms of finding your family is that you find them in the most interesting places that you just, you might be living next door to them and you never knew that this was your relative. Now, your father, talk about your father. Okay. I know we're going to talk more about the book, but I just wanted to know the early parts.
Right. No problem at all. And yeah, dad, born in Brooklyn also, grew up in Bensonhurst. That's where he came of age. And as back in the day, and even further back in the day than when we refer to back in the day, is that kids would just be out all day. You get up in the morning, eat breakfast, and then you're out all day. So daddy used to just be out. He used to go into the Manhattan from Brooklyn and come back dinner time. And that was expected. But yeah, dad did that often. He had a very interesting group of friends that we got to know by name. Billy Melnick, who was one of his best friends. Joe Cavazzano. So many people from all countries, Italian, different religions, Jewish. So he had a really great Greek guy whose name was Pete the Greek. So yeah, dad was a man of, so daddy was able to say, our Italians say this. So he had give us some Italian phrases, Jewish phrases, Yiddish phrases. And then again, his family, daddy's family, and my family is from Barbados. So on Macon Street, growing up, there's so many people on Macon Street at that point who were from the Caribbean. And so we grew up hearing that accent. Of course, we didn't really have that accent, but certain words we would say and hear. But yeah, dad went into the military. He was drafted and so he saw the world, really went around the world. It was different that at that point. Because the African-American GIs were segregated. And then once they were, later on, they became integrated. But for the most part, he was around Black folks all the time. And the interesting part, and I do talk about that real quick in the book, is that daddy didn't really experience so much racism, overt racism, let's say, growing up in Brooklyn. But once he started traveling around different parts of the country, then he started seeing people act a certain way, obviously, towards him and all the rest of the Black GIs, and seeing what Jim Crow looks like and meeting people who were obviously and overtly racist. So it was like an eye-opening time for him being from the North, who had to deal with that. And then the dad, he met mom at Brooklyn College. He was a world-traveled GI coming to Brooklyn College, so I'm sure he thought he was the ish. Well, he was the stuff, as you would say now, you know. And so I love to hear these two stories that mommy would tell about their meeting versus what daddy would tell. And, you know, but they, you know.
He probably said she changed me.
Of course. And mommy would look at him and say, really, Thomas? No, that's not how it was. But obviously it worked out well. And daddy and mommy got married in 1950 July. In fact, today, what's today? Say the 10th, whatever it is. In fact, today is their, would have been their anniversary, July 9th, 1950. So again, both of them have passed, but at the time of their passing, they had been married like about 63 years. So yeah, so all that grandstanding in the cafeteria at Brooklyn College worked out pretty well, 63 years. Yeah. And then daddy was a teacher. Dad was a teacher at Newtown High School. Then he became the director of the Brooklyn, at that point, Urban Center, which now is the Educational Opportunity Center of Brooklyn, one of many other offices around the state, New York State, affiliated with the State University of New York. So dad was there and he retired there and then basically just enjoyed life, enjoyed hanging out and traveling to Barbados with mommy and traveling to Mexico and Spain, all around the world with mommy. And then taking us early on, of course, he took us to see the homeland in Barbados, which I'll never forget, 1965, the first time we ever went, first time mommy and daddy ever went to. And it's interesting, Steve, from back in when we were young, people didn't travel as freely and easily and frequently as they do now. Now it's no big deal. In fact, you talk to some of these young people and say, yeah, I'm going to a bachelor party. Oh, yeah, where are we going? Oh, we're going down to Peru. to do a bachelor party for 3 days. My bachelor party, we went from Queens at the time into Manhattan. And it's like, okay, we spent money. We didn't spend thousands of dollars. But anyhow, but just that now, back then it was a big thing to travel back and forth. And my grandparents did not travel home, as we like to say it. They didn't travel home until they were well in their 50s or early 60s. But yeah, so daddy was beloved by all. Mommy was beloved by all. And we were very blessed, Tommy, Robin, and I, to have had a childhood that they created for us and sheltered us, and at the same time kicked our butts to make sure that we were going to be people who were going to be contributors to this world and be conscious of what we have and what we would like others to have. So I mean, that's a nutshell, mommy and daddy. I can go on for, you know, there's a lot of years I could talk about, so stop me when you want.
My Barbados story is being there with family.
Yes.
Walking past a pole. And on this pole, there's this car. Taco Bell, was it?
Yes, it was.
Taco Bell and your name on the car.
Yep.
That was fun. That was fun.
You know, Stephen, just real quick, you told me after you came back, it was at Mullins Bay Beach on the West Coast in Barbados. And there's a little grill and bar and restaurant there. Yes. And so you would put up your card there. And I remember you came back and you said, yeah, I saw your card. It was like one of those one in a million.
So tell me about, where did you go to college at?
All right.
I'm going to tell you something to that too.
Go ahead. All right. You want to hit your
first? No, you got to tell first.
All right. So, all right. I was a good student in high school, and I was fortunate to be able to be admitted to Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, early decision. So in November, I knew where I was going. November of my senior year, I knew where I was going. And so I went to Wesleyan and played freshman football up there. And I guess I forgot to study because I had started skating a little bit. And I would go, my brother Tommy went to Amherst. So I used to go up to Amherst and see him. And I was hanging out with, I was a freshman. So I was hanging out with sophomores and juniors, and they bought two hearses. So I used to go partying to hearses. My year, by the way, at Wesley was the first year that they admitted co-eds, females. But it was already in the minds of the upperclassmen that you leave the campus to go road tripping. So my first road trip ever as a Wesleyan student was to go to Wellesley and hung out up there. So yes, yeah, so I used to roll around in a hearse with my upperclass people. So now we come rolling into Smith College, Holyoke, Wellesley in hearses. So yes, yeah, so that was my experience there. So needless to say, without studying Sir Davis and going to class on a regular Sir Davis, you know, they said, you are required to resign. So I said, oh yeah. And they said, you can apply again for next year if you want, and for readmission. Again, I went from, again, being admitted early decision to being, after 1 year, required to resign. So I remember,
how did your father take it?
Oh man. it was terrible. Mommy was more upset about it. And especially, you know, they ask you, how you doing? I say, yeah, fine. Everything's fine. I knew, Steve, that in June, that letter was going to come that I got booted. And it came. And so I was like, all you can do is, what happened? I don't know. I didn't study. Why didn't you tell us? And we just hope for that moment to go by. Steve was coming. But yeah, they were very upset. And I was upset too, of course, trying to hide something from the parents who you respect and love for a whole academic year. And when I really felt it was when I took my oldest son, Hayward, to looking at colleges. So I'm the dad taking him to look at colleges. And I was just remembering, I was just thinking at that point how mommy and daddy felt taking me in particular, Tommy and Robin are the same, but taking me to colleges, how you feel proud. My child is going to start out. This is a good spot for him to do it. And I remember I called daddy when I was at a college, and I was choking it up. I said, daddy, I want to just tell you, I'm so sorry to have put you through the sadness of me flunking out. And so I was crying on the phone to daddy. He was like, no, I said, now I know how it must have felt, because I can imagine how it would, after having a sons, how mommy and daddy must have felt. So I really apologize to daddy. So I was happy to say that.
My son had one episode where he had drank some beer or something, and that's when he found out that he could not drink. He's never drank since that time, that I know of. But I had to talk to him about that. Then I had to think, damn, I did the same thing. How am I going to chastise him when I did the same thing? That's the great thing about parenthood, that you think about what you did, and then you, if you are smart and compassionate, then some of the, yes, you're disappointed, but then you understand why that happened and try to take actions so that it doesn't happen again. But then, right. Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, there we go. But it also gives you an understanding of what he's going through. And so you're not talking from an ivory tower. When I talk to ivory tower from an ivory tower, but we're talking, this has been my experience too. So I feel what you're feeling, and I know you'll get past it. It's a learning experience, but you learn and you just keep on moving. Yeah. So I went there after I finished at Wesleyan. Then I finished up and got my BA at York College, CUNY.
Bingo.
Bye-ya.
That's it. Okay. My daughter graduated from York also.
Yeah. York College. There we go.
So y'all two alumni of York.
There we go. Ah, there it is. Okay, cool. Very good. Then, yep. So yeah, after York, then I went and got my master's at Queens, and then went to got some certificates and things like that from Fordham for teaching. But that's my education. Could it have been better? Yeah. Could it have been my life? It's interesting, Steve, isn't it? You look at certain crossroads in your life, certain events in your life that precipitated a movement off the road that perhaps you thought you'd be on. And then when you look back at it, you say, what would have happened, had I stayed at Wesleyan, if I'd studied, or if I decided to actually go back and complete my studies there, how my life would have veered in a different way. So it's fun. It's like playing the what if game. What if John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and RFK and Medgar Evers, what if all of those people had lived? How would the country be different? So that's, I feel like at some point in my life, I would love to, that's something I'd like to do, is to write a what if book and then just pick one person and see how history would have changed.
I remember talking with my mother also, and she was telling me that she didn't go to college, but she didn't go to college because it wasn't offered to her. She was expected really to go to South Carolina State. And although she was born in New York, she went back and forth to South Carolina because that's where her grandparents and stuff were from. And she said, if I look now and what if I would have taken studying seriously and gone to college? And I said, I wouldn't have been here. That's what would have happened. You graduate from college. Yes. What was your first job?
First job out of college was working for, at that point, it was New York City Community College, which is now CUNY Tech. And I was a tutor. I was tutoring my senior year. So I just continued there full time. So teaching English to students, and the students, of course, range from regular college age to, I always remember there was this guy from India who probably at the time was in his 60s, teaching him how to speak English and how to conjugate a verb and things like that. Rao Shunju, that was his name. Rao Shunju. It's funny, you still remember names like that. So that was my first job. I did that for a bit. And then I decided to go back to get my master's soon thereafter. Yeah, in 76, I went and started my master's at Queens College in Urban Studies. And I had thought about, I really had wanted to go to law school at one point because of my checkered undergrad career. I wasn't able to get in. So the same kind of things, like what if I had gone to law school, but I didn't. So I'm, of course, very pleased with how my life turned out. So yes, I went, got my master's, got that in 77 from that. And I think one of the crowning achievements for me that I was very proud of prior to this book is I wrote a thesis. It's called A Union for the Workers, the master's thesis. A Union for the Workers, The history of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. So I took it was a history from the time of its founding in like the 20s and 30s, and the events that led up to its formation up until the time that I wrote it, which was in the 70s. And that was, it was really my, I was very proud of the work that I put in there. It's very comprehensive. And so, yeah, so I like to look back at that. And yep, so I graduated from that. And then my first job after that, after getting my master's, was a management training program with Sears Roebuck and Company. I was in a buyer's program, management training for to be a buyer at Sears. So I was on 1633 Broadway in Manhattan, right at like about, that's about 50th Street and Broadway. So I did that for about 3 years, Steve. It was great.
When was that?
That would have been about 78-ish. I was
You were on Broadway at that time. This is interesting. And I had never added to you because at that time, 78, 79, yeah. 82, 83, I had an office at 250 West 57th Street.
Oh, okay.
And I used to, I had an advertising agency that I owned with someone. And I used to walk down to 16 over there because M. Morton Hall had his offices right across the street. There were so many wonderful people on the second floor where I was at. Butch Lewis had his offices. Harry Belafonte was on 7th Avenue and 57th Street. Stella and Mara used to be right down the street.
Wow.
The Pips, too. Edward and William had an office on 57th between Broadway and 7th.
Wow, man. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now, you probably didn't know where Beefsteak Charlie's was. That was right across the street.
We used to go there all the time. As a matter of fact, there was right there on 57th because across the street, the Bee Gees was at. They had their offices in that building. There were a lot of other folks that had their offices, but that down below, that used to be that restaurant, Brew Burger, on the bottom level. I used to hang out with at that time. He was in the movie with Godfrey Cambridge, Calvin Lockhart. NAACP used to be across the street.
Wow.
So all the people in NAACP used to come over and we drink, and it was a fun time. It was really a fun time.
It was a beautiful time. I know. That's when it was in to be Black. it was such a wonderful moment, wonderful time coming out of the 60s, where you felt like you were really bringing something special, because we talked it in the 60s, but in the 70s and the early 80s, we started actually putting it in effect and using some of the power that we were dreaming about. And then it started to be whittled away because that's a whole nother show, isn't it, Sir Davis?
Okay, now you are at Sears. And just before then, I had a management training program also. My management training program was for Household Finance before I.
Oh,
and I worked for Household as a manager for a while.
Okay.
I hung in there. They tried to get rid of me because what had happened was Household had to have a consent decree. And I'm sure Sears probably had to have the same thing, but they had to hire one out of every four people had to be Black, and one out of every four had to be a woman.
Wow.
So when I went to, I had an account in Household when I was in North Carolina, and I wanted to move back to New York, and I was in making a payment, and the manager said, "Would you like to work here?"
Wow, Steve. You know what I'm saying?
And I had to make a really hard decision whether I wanted to continue to be a media reader and have dogs chase me, or work in this air-conditioned office. That was a hard decision. And I got to move back to New York with a job.
Oh, man. No. That was quickly done. Uh-huh. And so Sears was like retrenching a little bit. So they were going to be closing that particular buying office. And I could have moved to Chicago. They said that if you want, we're offering, everybody's guaranteed jobs in Chicago. You can come out a couple of times to look at homes and we'll help to relocate you and everything like that. And I was like, I'm not going to Chicago. You know, I'm staying here. I'm not, all my friends and family are here. And I didn't really like the corporate culture. After a while, I got it, understood it, and knew how to play it and stuff like that. But I didn't love Sears enough to want to go. So that's another moment, Steve, where it's, okay, what if I had actually gone out to Chicago, become a Sears and Roebuck guy, or not?
The first Black CEO Sears.
That would have been something, although Roebuck was Black. but I said, no, thank you. I'm not gonna move. I'm just going to stay here. And again, Steve, that was like 1978, 25. Stuff was
party time.
Yeah, right. You know, I got to make a little money, put on my little suit every day. And so, yes, I said, no, thank you. And they said, you want to go out and look at some houses? You take a trip. I said, you know what? I'm not going to waste your money. I'm not going to waste my time because I'm not going to go. And so then I just went and got another job. And my job after that was working for the New York City Office of Economic Development. So I was doing commercial development for New York City. That was under the Koch administration. And that was great. I really enjoyed that a lot. Got my feet wet and doing some economic development, small economic development projects, and got to understand that language. And it's funny when you go from, when I went from Sears, Fortune 500 company, to the city, when I first started working at Sears, they give you like boxes of pens, boxes of pencils, stacks of staples and all that kind of stuff when you're starting your job. Pads, tons of pads. And then I remember going to the city and they're saying, oh, I need some pencils. And they said, okay. So they came, gave me a pencil. Can I get a pen, some pens? And they came over, gave me one pen. So I got to see private sector versus municipal government. I said, oh. And then even the pads that you take messages on while you're out, such and such. So at Sears, of course, it was like the nice pink one with all the check marks you can just put in here and all pre-written. And went to the city and it was just recycled paper that was cut up that I get my messages in. So I said, I see how this works. And then one other thing about that, going from private to public sector, Steve, is this, the whole notion of people used to brag, say, oh, this was Carlisle Leach. He came from private. And people were like, oh, you came from the private sector, you know? So it's like, yeah. So later on, I got to see how that really works. Some people were like, eyebrows raised when you say that you came from the private sector. So yeah, so I stayed there for a good while, Steve, and then left and had an opportunity to work for the New York State Department of Commerce, known for the I Love New York campaign. So I was working in the Division of Minority and Women Business at 230 Park Avenue, which is that beautiful building right in the middle of Park Avenue. That was sweet. I really enjoyed working there. And again, so my area was New York State. So I got a chance to travel a lot throughout New York State and get great leadership at that point at the Division of Minority and Women's Business. So we went down to DC a lot, just spreading the word about how to increase work for getting more contracts for minority businesses. So that really shaped me a lot also, just to see how things work and how things don't work. So yeah, so I did that for a while. Then after sort of being around lots of business people, in talking to people and advising them, I said, you know what, I could do this. So that's when I formed my first company, which was Leach Associates Consulting. And I got a contract with the city of New York, and I was doing some things up in Harlem, which is now the site of the Magic Johnson Theater. So I was there like dealing with merchants. And I was also, another contract I had was with the Pitkin Avenue Merchants Association, doing some marketing and increasing business opportunities for businesses on Pitkin Avenue. So again, that was beautiful. That was my first foray into having my own company. So one thing I'm proud of too, is that somewhere or another, I have the contract that I signed by that point, they still had the New York City Board of Estimate. So I still have the contract, which says City of New York and Leach Associates Consulting, the contract. So I was like, yeah, this is my first contract. So yeah, so that was—
Did you celebrate? Incredible.
I did celebrate. I don't know what I did. There's so many options to celebrate back in the day. And
you really didn't need an excuse to celebrate, because we celebrated just to celebrate.
Yes, we did. And there's no, again, Steve, weren't there so many places to celebrate? Right? You just roll into places.
You would leave work at 5 o'clock. There was always a bar downstairs. You stop in the bar then particularly in the area when you on Broadway area, you go into Pippin's or one of the other clubs. Yeah. And then if you lived on the Upper West Side, like I did,
McKell's
or
Sellers. And what's that? Rusty's
Round and Peter Brown. Man.
Yeah, there you go.
And then you'd find an after-hour place. Right. But you had to go to work the next day. You wouldn't get in until about 6 o'clock. You put some water on your face and then head straight to work.
Yep. And then be productive, surprisingly productive. And then that would be Thursday night. And then Friday night, you'd do it again.
Do it again. Yep.
Those were like the crazy fun days. And that's why I used to go clubbing all the time, 60s, 70s and 80s. So many parties. Yeah, so many parties. And it's funny how, you know, that club scene is not similar. Of course, it won't be the same. It's another generation. But I know we had big fun. Like I said, Justine's, of course, Leviticus, yeah, and all of them, you know, Pegasus and all those kind of places. Act yes. One, La Martinique.
Those were the days, my friend. I thought they never end.
But they did, you know. They got phased out. But yeah, I was very happy during those times. Yeah, Stephen. So those are some of the gigs that I had, and from that time when I first had my contract with the city, then I got other contracts and just started writing business plans for people and started investing in certain opportunities and just kept at it. And then decided soon after that, that I wanted to settle down in terms of having children. And I got married in 85. I love the action of writing business plans and investing, but I wanted something more steady. So I'm not always chasing down money and things like that. That's when I became a teacher in 1991. And so, yeah, so I was a teacher. And that's when I started being a social studies teacher. And that was a wonderful experience. I was at my first job was at Sarah J. Hale, downtown Brooklyn, and which was wonderful. I still have a good number of students who are Facebook friends of mine, who actually, Stephen, bought the book, wrote reviews on the book, reacted to the book, and just saying, one young lady in particular who's now in her 40s, she said her dad died in 2013, just like my dad. And so the book resonated even deeper with her. Yeah, but it was a wonderful time playing. And then all during this time, Steve, I was always coaching baseball. Before I had Hayward in August, I was always coaching baseball. I was coaching baseball when I was still living in Queens. And that's always been a part of what I love to do. And just showing young men how to play the game and showing them what I learned from my dad, from my uncle and my grandfather. And and I still coach today, coach my younger son, August. We have a team called the Dukes, and we play in Central Park and at Parade Grounds in Brooklyn. We probably play about 50, 60 games, 70 games a year, different various leagues into the fall. And I love it that we do. Yeah, we play all the time. And
tell me, when you left the business world, your first day in front of these students, how did you feel? How was it?
I love the kids. Nothing like high school kids in Brooklyn in 1991. Anytime. The first day, I remember the first thing I did was, it was a homeroom. So I had to, you know, call out names and things like that. And just the innocence of the kids, I was taken by that. Where when you're a teacher, you look at the kids and some of them look a little ominous. But they're trusting, they don't know me. They're trusting me that I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to teach them and I'm going to say their name correctly when I call their name. And so that first day, I was euphoric. I was very happy as I have an opportunity to talk to the kids. And I was very idealistic in dealing with them. And that was the first time I was teaching history. Fortunately, I had really good history teachers growing up. And then Daddy was also a history teacher. So I got some of that through osmosis as well. But after the first class where I'm teaching, how it is, homeroom is one thing because you don't have to teach. It's really just, hey, everybody, yep, here's some announcements. When you're teaching, it's a whole different thing. And that was tough. And I remember that first year was tough because I want the best for the kids. And so they disappointed me a lot. I said, don't you, come on, let's go. I'm trying to teach you something. And I think it's going to help you in your life. And basically, I just want to get out of school. I don't care about school. I got so many other things going on. So it was a learning experience for me. So I understood that teaching is not only teaching content, but it really is teaching about life and just trying to find something in those children that will make them turn their head towards the content and to learn and really extrapolate something from that content that they can relate to. So again, that first year, there's so many times I wanted to just quit. And especially because I started in 91 and it was like October 91, February 92 is when I had our first son. So I'm in front of the computer writing lesson plans and I have Hayward in snuggly in front of me. It's 11 o'clock and I know I have to get up the next day. I'm wiped out. It's like, why am I doing this? I'm tired. Then it works out. Then suddenly you start to understand things better with the kids. And again, even today I see them and they're like, yeah, Mr. Leach, you were really tough on us, but we always know that you always knew that you cared about us. So they took that toughness the way I was presenting it. Yeah, you're like my kids. So I'm teaching you, I'm giving you me because I'm caring about you. And like I say, even to this day, and some of them came to Dad's funeral too, because they had met my father and met my mom. So came to Mom's funeral. And it really is, if you want to become immortal, Mr. Davis, teach, because every word that you say to them, they remember for the rest of their lives. And they share those Stephen Davis stories with their kids. And it goes on and on. So that's, if nothing, just something that I don't think teachers think about. So for every kid that you interacted with, whether in class or just walk by you in the hallway, you impact on kids. And I really took that responsibility very seriously. And the kids know, the kids feel that. And
how long were you at Sarah Hale?
I was at Sarah J. Hale until 96. And then I wrote a proposal. And I'll tell you about that. Go ahead.
And I probably was about 93, 94. I had a television show called Illuminations that was on PBS on the Board of Education channel, actually, channel 25. Mm-hmm. And I got to do the makeup for me. Students from Sarah J. Hale.
No, that's right, because they have cosmetology. That's right.
Yep. They came and they would do the hair for our guests.
Yep. Yep. Do you remember the teacher? Was it Miss? It was a tall sister.
Yes. Yes.
I forgot her name. Tall, like long leg.
I didn't look at her legs.
Come on, brother.
I told somebody. I told Sheila Frazier. I didn't watch her in the bathtub scene. She said, yeah, really.
That's cool about Sarah J. Yeah, so you probably met some of my students. You met them. So, I'm sure if I showed you some pictures, you'd say, yeah, I remember that. But yeah, that was a great experience with them. And like I said, now those kids who worked on you, Stephen, they're in their 40s. And an interesting thing is that so many of them were forced to leave out of New York City, out of Brooklyn, because they couldn't afford it. Couldn't raise their families here. North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Kentucky.
I was in Georgia at the Hilton Hotel in Atlanta. I was staying there and I was walking across the lobby and somebody said, Mr. Davis. And I looked around and looked at her and she said, you don't remember me. I had adopted a school. The school that I adopted used to be John Marshall, but it became Mary McLeod Bethune. And I adopted that school and she was part of that whole effort.
She was a student in there.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So I understand that. What you said. My only problem was I always felt that if I taught that I'd probably end up in jail. See, you had the patience.
I know, Stephen. I know. I did. Yeah. But after the first year, after your first year, you would understand it. You would get it. Okay. You just get thicker skin. My skin just got thicker. So I didn't take it so personally. But yeah, but didn't it make you feel really wonderful for somebody
to
have
did.
That experience?
And my daughter, she left Moody's.
Okay.
To become a teacher. She was on the fellowship and she got her master's by teaching. And she They had hired her to teach the fifth grade. But at the last minute, they told her, no, you're going to have to teach the first grade because there's another teacher who had a little bit more seniority. So she said she got in front of the students and said, okay, open up your books and read this page. And they looked at her like, are you crazy? And she realized, oh, I got to teach you to read.
That's right.
So I've always appreciated teachers and yes. understand the trepidation that they go through, and they're never paid enough.
I agree.
You want society to move on, but you don't want to pay people who are going to prepare society to move on. Right. That's sometimes the most.
And you had that experience about providing that analysis and assessment of education since you had the show and you're involved so greatly in trying to change that, trying to change the perception. And you value what our country, capitalist country, value what you pay for. So if you say, I'm not going to pay teachers at the same level as...
What do you say? Exactly
right. And the kids know that too. And there's a question that was asked of us teachers when I was teaching was, do you advise your smartest kids to go into teaching? And every teacher said, no, I don't. I don't advise my smartest kids to go into teaching. And then we had to check ourselves. Wow, why is that? And we feel because it's the value that you are or not given.
Let's move on to the book. I want to spend some time with your book. And one of the things for me in terms of your book is that because I knew that your father was larger than life, when he walked in the room, you knew he was there. Yep. And he was always so very kind. Talk about the book. What made you decide to write the book?
I had the title of the book first because Dad went into the hospital because he wasn't breathing well and he wasn't feeling comfortable. And so I said, Dad, he said, let's go to the doctor, see what's going on with you. And so from the time that he went in just to check himself out to the time he expired, to the time he passed away, was 6 days. So it was a rapid decline. And I just remember in my head, it was like 6 days. And it was 6 days and it was December. And so after Dad passed away, I was in my head, I said, I should try to document what I can remember. And I just started writing every day, everything that I could remember, conversations, feelings, smells, everything. And I just started writing, but in a diary style, said this happened. And so I just felt like there were moments in there that I really wanted to memorialize and crystallize for myself on the one hand, two, be able to share it with family, and three, have it shared with other people who I know have been through and will be going through similar types of experiences with their loved ones. And I thought it was extra germane just because of how the impossibility of people to be with their dying family members during COVID, where you drop your loved one off and then you just wait for the call a couple of days later to say that your parent or your daughter or your sister or whatever friend died. And so I really started to understand the blessing that we had to be able to be with Daddy at his side when he died. I wasn't actually there when he died. Nobody was there. And people like to say that oftentimes the person who's going to die sort of like waits to maybe die by themselves so that it's not a trauma for whoever's watching him. But yeah, and I just felt like I wanted to just write it down, get it down. And then, and I tell you, excuse me, Steve, it's been so humbling. And first of all, I really want to thank you, Stephen, for inviting me to come on the Stephen Davis Show. And this is the first time that I am talking about it other than to other family members and to friends. But I do appreciate the time that you to give me to talk about it. And I appreciate Thank what you. You just said about my dad too. And yeah, Daddy was bigger than life. As a son, how much even more bigger, quote unquote, he was to me as a son. And to Robin and to Tommy as well. And I just wanted to get it down. And so I did, I wrote it and then fashioned it into a story that I thought would be interesting. So it's not just reading in a diary of somebody, try to capture what I was feeling, what was going on in my head, what was going on in perhaps daddy's head. And I just really wanted to make this sort of an honoring my dad. I wrote this book to really honor my dad and honor my mom, like in her role. At that point, as mom had heavy Alzheimer's and dementia, so she wasn't really present mentally or physically, but she was still on the earth and actually outlived dad. But yeah, I wanted to honor my father. In the Bible, it's like, honor thy father and thy mother. So I felt, you feel like you want to give, and I just wanted to. So that's the idea of the book, Steve.
My impression in terms of when I was reading the book was that your father faced death as he faced life head on. It was, okay, this is going to happen. It's going to happen soon. Because there's a passage in your book where you talk about he's telling you different instructions, like preparing. I'm not going to be here, so I want you to make sure you do this and this and make sure you got that. It's sort of the Godfather when he was saying, you know.
Exactly. That's good. I like that. I like that.
How was the interaction with the different people coming in and out? How did it make you feel in terms of knowing the impending death?
How did I feel? I was happy that we all had that opportunity to interact with dad. And then for us to interact with each other as we were knowing that these were the final days of dad on earth. And so I was happy. And everybody had their time with him. We talked to him and hold him and just sear in our brains his aroma, touching his hair, touching his ear, touching his face, everything, just touching his hands. I tried to really sort of like stamp that in all of my senses. And I was happy that we had that same, all of us, to my knowledge, had that same type of interaction with him. And then you know how it is, Steve, you said that he's larger than life, so that when somebody who's larger than life is vulnerable, you say it's a wake up call to yourself too. Everybody knows they're going to die. But when you see the man who's your greatest hero ever he's in a weakened situation physically, but still there, very strong mentally. So when you see that, if daddy can die, I know I'm going to die. And I hope I have the same resilience and serenity and wisdom about when I'm in my final days and I'm not like looking around like, just screaming like, which I'm not going to do. You just like, because you start thinking about it. So I felt happy that we all were there around daddy talking to him.
I posted on Facebook a copy of your book.
Thank you.
To my friends and people that are on Facebook. But my comment was that when it's my time to go, I hope that I go in the same way in terms of my family feeling the same way that your father's family felt towards him. It's wonderful to be able to say, I love this person. And yes, all of us have to die at some point. But some people you want to die before they do.
Not that you're willing it, you know, you're just thinking about it, projecting. You know, it's like one of those crossroads again. It's like, how would it be if they was dead?
I remember when my father died, he was 80 years old and he was still working. He didn't have to work, but he was still working as a mail carrier. He had been in the Army for 30 years, got out, became a mail carrier, got sick on his route. And somebody said to him, you need to go to the hospital. And he went to the hospital, and the next day he was dead.
Wow.
He never got to say goodbye or anything else like that. I do appreciate the way that you all handle it, and it's a lesson for all of us in terms of something that is inevitable. This is not a morbid show, but it is a show to say we're going to talk about stuff, and death is part of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely, you know? And appreciate. Yeah, and Steven, just appreciate the people. See them. We're all busy, but sometimes it's just, let me just look at grandma. Let me just look at aunt, you know, uncle. Let me just look at him. Let me ask him or her some questions. Because now, freaking A, there's so many questions I wish I had asked him. So yeah, so it's an even little thing, Steve. They'll just say, Dad, what do you think about this? Just, oops, I don't have Dad. So my sons are asking me questions. And so just by being on this earth a little bit longer, we have some knowledge that we can share with our children. But yeah, Stephen, So anyhow, but the book, I'm happy at the response that I'm getting. And it seems to have touched folks in ways that I didn't even fathom. And
tell people how they can get the book.
Oh, they could just go to Amazon.com and just put in there 6 days in December. And my father's journey home, just put that in there. It comes up. It's reasonably priced. And if you want an ebook, it's available in ebook as well. And it's just it's a quick read, 6 days. And I hope that you get what I was trying to share with you. And again, I thank you for saying it's not a morbid, I don't mean to bring people down in talking about this, but it is, we live, we're going to die. And the people that we love are going to live and they're going to die as well. So appreciate who's with you now, because it's not my grandmother, my dad's mom used to say, you're not promised tomorrow. And it's true. You're not promised tomorrow. And so, yeah. So
I'm going to fight hell to keep going.
Exactly right. And that's why we try to fill our days with lots of activities, but at the same time, be reflective and be aware of every present moment, because the present moment is here every day. Every moment, there's a new present and we change our future. So that's how I felt, Steve.
I thank you so much for being on this broadcast. It's wonderful to see you. And I wish you well in the book. Actually, just my suggestion.
Yes, sir.
Is that this book would make a great play.
Stephen, I thank you. And my son, Hayward, went to Juilliard. He's an actor now. My youngest son, August, is a teacher at Brooklyn Friends School. But I told Hayward already, I said, Hayward, write a book, write a play for this. But thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, it would make a great play.
Thank you. Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay, that's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Peace all.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Hello, my name is Jewel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is an author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!